ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Rafael Bonicella grew up in a working-class town in northern Spain. He was born when General Franco was still in power. And as the eldest of four boys, Rafael was expected to set a kind of manly example to his brothers. Rafael's father was the product of a predominantly macho culture of the time. But all Rafael wanted to do as a kid was to dance. But there was no dance school in his town. So he was dancing at home and pulling on leg warmers to put on performances in the town. Rafael figured that he'd have to escape his hometown if he was going to survive and flourish. And that's what he did. He got a dance scholarship, then joined a dance company, came to London and trained some more. Then he was given a position at the prestigious Rambert Dance Company and eventually tried his hand as a choreographer. And then, out of the blue, Rafael was contacted by Kylie Minogue, who wanted Rafael to choreograph her song Can't Get You Out of My Head for the Brit Awards ceremony, which was, without doubt, her most sublime song and video clip. At the same time, Rafael was refining his own poetic style of contemporary dance. And in 2008, he came to Australia to create his first full-length production for the Sydney Dance Company, after the company was rocked by an unexpected and completely awful tragedy. In 2009, Rafael became the Sydney Dance Company's artistic director and raised it even higher to become one of the most revered contemporary dance companies in the world. And the Sydney Dance Company's new production, Memento, opens on May 28 and will be touring around Australia. Hello, Rafael.
Hello, Richard.
Tell me about this town, La Garriga, that you grew up in northern Spain.
La Garriga is a beautiful little town surrounded by mountains and, you know, close enough to Barcelona that you can just get there in 30 minutes and be in a city, in an urban environment, but a very quiet, little, beautiful town with a lot of wonderful modernist architecture, actually. It's a spa town, so it has these natural spring waters. And I happened to be born there because my family, my grandparents, emigrated from the south of Spain post-war, you know, Franco times, while they were trying to find a better life.
From Andalusia?
From Andalusia, yes.
Right, down in the south. Was this part of a project to make Catalonia more Spanish rather than less Catalan, do you think?
Well, no, I think in this case was just actually looking for, you know, work and a job and better life. And the buses landed, stopped wherever they stopped. And that's where the families were placed.
And what kind of work were they doing?
They worked in textile. So one of the big industries at the time in that area was textile factories. My dad did the day shift. My mother did the night shift. And everything else that a mother did.
Did you grow up then in a culture of hard work? And have you always been about hard work? Because you strike me as a really hardworking human being.
Right. Absolutely. There was this sense of making us understand what hard work meant and how you had to work hard to get things. So my father was very determined. And since we were young, he had a piece of land and we worked the land with him. So every vegetable imaginable and every tree with every fruit that was part of our lives, and we would spend the weekends there working and working hard.
And were they like British working class people, which is we're working class, you're going to be working class all your life, or did they want something more for you than that?
No, they wanted more. They definitely, you know, my parents, my grandparents, probably they didn't go to school. You know, my parents did go to school, but had to work from the age of 15. And they wanted us to be going to university. And they did that. And Spain, you know, there was a renaissance. There was a big shift happening in the 80s. I mean, I wasn't aware of it in terms of culturally because I was a little boy. But, you know, Pedro Almodóvar, La Movida in Madrid, you know, things that we're seeing now were starting to happen then.
And this was just after the death of General Franco and the country was liberalizing, becoming democratic, and it was flourishing all of a sudden, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. In every single way. And, you know, even the teachers in the school, like we were the first generation to allow to speak Catalan. Can you believe that? So my mom spoke Catalan, but everything was in secret within the families. And then in the schools, if the teacher was a math teacher that spoke Catalan, the maths would be in Catalan. So there was that merge between the old school, you know, I'll hit you behind the head if you get something wrong, to actually, you know, becoming a, this is not okay.
Was there much cultural life in the city, and was there anyone to promote cultural life in La Garriga?
I was so incredibly lucky every time I think about it, because La Garriga had the first ever female mayor in Spain, post-Franco. That's progressive. Of course, I was not aware of that either. You know, there was a woman running the town. Hey, amazing. She's a poet. She's alive. She's in her 90s. And I truly believe, seeing the world, even right now, that the fact that there was a woman that was running that town as a leader, and she was a writer, a poet, you know, she brought culture to the town.
And how did she do that?
So whenever there was the festivities in summer, which happened in July for 2 weeks, and the whole town goes to town, so there's music, there's dance, there's theater, street theater, everything was for free. Any opportunity to offer the town, whether it was music or theater or anything, she did what she could.
And did the whole town come out to watch it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I was part of that. You know, like once they built a theater in the square, the main square of the town, there is the town hall, there is the church. And there was a stage, and I presented my, I didn't know it was called choreography, but it was my dance to the town.
And when did you know you were going to be not to be a dancer, but do you remember a moment as a child when you saw something? Was it on TV or in public, or was it flamenco? I don't know, where you went, oh, I've got to do that.
Absolutely. There was Thriller, the video.
Thriller, Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson, because he did a 10-minute video.
Yeah.
So it was a very long video with a lot of dancing. But what really, really did it was Fame, the series.
Right, Juilliard Performance School. It's not That's Performing right. Arts School, right.
1982, I bought the book, I've got the cassette, and I saw this series on TV, which was after lunch, and I was like, oh my God, these people are going to a school and they've been taught how to dance, and there's names to the steps, and there's a teacher that's, you know, saying you have to sweat to succeed, and that was really key for me.
I'm going to live forever, light up the sky like a flame. Did that resonate with you?
Absolutely. I wanted it. I just wanted it. And suddenly I saw it. So I actually used to have a radio program in school when I was in 12 or something with my other friends from school. And, you know, because I was into the performing arts, every Friday night, it's called Radio Silenci. That's the name of the program. Not of the radio, but in La Garriga. And I would talk about a character of Fame every week. I mean, I don't even know if anyone was interested. Oh. But I still have that book that I asked my mom to give me money to buy. And then the cassette, I don't even know if it still works, but I have it.
And were you the boy dancing around the house or constantly looking for a venue then to perform in?
Look, you know, we had a little group that we made up from in the neighborhood. Yeah, and it was the girls and me.
Just then you and girls, no other boys? Was it too scary for the other boys to do that?
Well, no, I did force my two brothers, Iván and José, until they were old enough to realize that that was not cool. But, you know, when they're sort of 7 and 8 and 10, you know, my brother is like, oh, yeah, remember, you make me go and buy some tights, you know, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, oh, well, you know, chill. Very recently, that comment. So my brothers were, and then there was a couple more, but, you know, I was the one that was really, like, obsessed by it.
This isn't quite what your father wanted for you, though, was it, Raphael?
Well, it was just so like, yeah, not what the oldest boy of a family does. You know, football would have been better. He loved hunting, so there was a lot of hunting.
Did he take you hunting?
Yes, I did go hunting, just rabbits, and we ate them. So, you know, it was just part of that thing of like, you go hunting and we eat this because, you know, and then we go to work the land. And then my mom is like, oh, I have to take Rafa to singing lessons. And my father would be like, oh my God, once again, any excuse to get out of working the land. So, you know, I had my mother next to me, just knowing that I enjoyed so much singing and dancing and playing the guitar, and everything that was artistic was part of my life. So, yeah, he struggled with that. But at the same time, I know he was proud of it, but he couldn't say it. So it was all really a bit messed up in a way.
Do you think maybe there are two thoughts going on in your dad's head? I'm trying to read his mind from the distance and a long time ago. But on the one hand, he wants you to toughen up for a tough macho world that he'd grown up in. But on the other hand, he wants you to grow out of that and have a better life.
Absolutely. But there is something called pride that will stop people from becoming better people or more open people or move with the times, you know, because they have this pride thing that's actually not good. So for him, there was this thing about not letting go of certain things. But, you know, I have pictures of me dancing in the town, festivities, and everyone around clapping and he's smiling from ear to ear and he's totally enthusiastic. But he had had such a hard life that he was never able to express in a way. But I know, because other people told me, your father is so proud of, and your father told me this, and your father, but he never told me.
Some men don't have the language for that.
Yeah. And, you know, the therapist also did tell me that if you've never been given love, it's very hard to know how to give love.
Did your brothers also try and rebel against your father's strong influence?
Yeah, they did. One by one. You know, so I moved to London, and then my brothers, who, you know, we're like 2 years apart, then another 2 years apart, so we're very close. And then as they became teenagers and they started finding their own hobbies and their own way of seeing life and their own way, and maybe felt like, oh, you know what, I don't love this hunting thing so much, or I don't want to go and spend my weekend looking for the potatoes or whatever it was that was that season, then they rebelled and they, you know, one by one fell out with my dad.
And you, as this bright kid who wants to dance in leg warmers, the kind of leg warmers you saw in Fame in public, in a macho culture, did that make you a target?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It happened, but I don't know why I managed to get through it. Sometimes it was harder because I was unashamedly wanting to do it. So in the school, in the break, you know, you have a break in the middle of the day. We call it el recreo. It's where you go and play with your friends for half an hour. I can't remember how long it was. I'll be making a dance with my boogie box. And then in Spain, you have a break in the day because of the weather. So you go home, you eat at home, and then you start school at 3. We would go earlier with the boogie box and I would make a dance. So yes, I was a target. Yes, I was bullied and called words and people would run after me, and there was not really nice situations, but somehow I managed to just, my passion for it and determination was like, I don't care. Somehow I managed to filter it, and I still remember myself as a happy child, which is a good thing.
How old were you when you were able to take your first dance class?
15.
Oh, that's quite late, isn't it?
Yeah. My father took me with a car to Barcelona.
Was he proud of you?
Probably, I don't know, he just wanted to check it out, you know, and he was going to pay for it. But, you know, there was always conditions. That was part of my childhood. There was always conditions. You know, you always had to do something for something. So I had to finish up to the end of high school before you go to university, which I was fine with because I also, you know, I didn't know if I would ever make it myself. So I had this desire, but will I ever become a dancer? I didn't know that because my ignorance about everything in terms of, you know, I ended up being contemporary dance. I'd never even been to a show. So he took me to this place and they paid for me to go every Friday to take a jazz class.
And how quickly did you progress once you started taking your first proper lessons?
So it was 1 year of that. And then the teachers said to, I was 15, and the teacher said to my parents, this boy has talent and we want to give him a scholarship to come the year after. When I was 16, every day in the morning, there was a course that you did 3 classes a day in the morning, and then I could do high school in the evening. So that was the beginning of the absolute obsession about, okay, I think this could happen. My parents didn't have to pay, so I was given a scholarship. Then I discovered ballet, flamenco, there was flamenco lessons, there was contemporary dance, there was jazz, there was a little bit of everything.
And that means you have to go to Barcelona every day. What was your daily routine like?
It was super early, like I'd been a trainer at 7 in the morning, 6:30, I arrived to Barcelona. I get on the metro because it was not in where the stop was with the train. And I finish at 3 or 4. Then I would go to another town that was on the way to my town, which is just before and bigger, and do the evening high school, which was from 6 until 10. Then I would go to the train again and get the train back to my town. arrive home like at 11, have dinner, go to sleep, study, get up for a study. I started losing my hair. There was absolute stress. And there was then all of it, everything else going on, you know. So it was a lot.
Yeah. Were you happy though?
I was happy. I was like, everything I have ever wanted, it was finally happening.
So you joined your first dance company. How did that happen?
Well, the first dance company was actually in Barcelona. I was 17, and the contemporary dance teacher that I had that year, Neus Ferrer was her name, she said to me, oh, there's a contemporary dance company doing an audition. I think you should go. I'm like, sure. Yes, let's do it. I went to an audition. I was 17, and I got a job. My parents had to sign the contract. I had never been to a contemporary dance show. I didn't really know what contemporary dance was.
Well, hang on, you joined a contemporary dance company.
Yeah.
And you'd never been to a contemporary dance show?
Yes.
But had that been what you were doing all along to some degree, inventing your own dance routines?
That's right, but it was a bit more pop.
Yeah.
You know, which came handy later on in my life. But at that point, it was, you know, making dances to pop songs.
Did that give you a chance, though, to see? I'm sure you would have known of women who could go on to become professional dancers, but did that put you in the company of men who were professional dancers, that were kind of role models?
It was more than that. The company at the time was only men. They actually started as a men-only contemporary dance company, which was rare. It was the beginning of contemporary dance in Spain also, because everything was changing.
And were they lovely and did they welcome you? Or was it like, who's this talented fella coming in?
Well, they were like, "Who's this? Where is this coming from? This person that's had 1 year training and we tell him to do this and he can do it." But I was highly untrained. You know, 1 year training is not enough.
And they might have been bourgeois too while you were working class boys. So were there holes in your cultural knowledge that
No, I think, they came a little bit from everywhere. I mean, the director had been to New York, to the Cunningham Center, and with a scholarship from the Basque country, which was really supporting talent to go overseas and stuff. But they were certainly a lot more knowledgeable and worldly than me. But because I was 17, they were maybe in their 30s or late 20s. And, you know, I suddenly was in Paris, I was in Austria, I was in Vienna, I was in Budapest, I was in Zagreb, I was in this international tour in Europe from not having a clue what contemporary dance. I was dancing to weird music with weird costumes. And it felt right.
Fantastic. So you sound that to me like a guy, someone who's just feeling his way forward in the dark to some degree. Was that what you were like?
Look, opportunities came to me. And I gave them a go. And really, truly, you said it, you know. I really did not know what contemporary dance was. But I just loved dance. And at that point, for me, there was no distinction between I'm making dance to, a pop song, and now I'm dancing to really weird contemporary music or actually really incredible classical music. With them, I discovered Bartok. Some of the music was actually quite, you know, classical and, you know, important. But I didn't know that because I'd never been to a classical music concert. I could not get enough of it now as an adult and, you know, later on in life. I remember going to Budapest and classical CDs were really, really cheap. So I bought like 30 classical, not CDs, records. It was the time of records. And I started to self-educate myself. You know, so they actually hold my hand in a way. And then I was in Vienna and I went to museums with them and I was in Paris and I performed in the Opera Comique. But what was interesting is that I saw other dance companies.
And what did you learn from that, from seeing other dance companies?
That I needed more training. That actually, yes, 1 year in Barcelona had been enough to sort of give me some tools. But when I saw, you know, I remember seeing Batsheva, I remember seeing the Merce Cunningham Dance Company, some French companies, because French really supported dance. And then I was like, oh my God, all these dancers can do all these things. And I'm sort of doing it, but not really being in control.
So you have to learn how to move. You have to learn how to...
The technique.
You know, is that like learning a musical instrument, or is it something different from that? Is it learning to move in a certain way or understanding how to create certain kinds of movement?
The music instrument is a good analogy, because it's practice. It's practice and training. So, you know, you do it and you do it again and you practice and you do it again and you get better. So for me, there was a natural way that I could move. And in contemporary dance, the beautiful thing is that you can take from that. You know, you don't need to be sort of exactly the same to everyone else.
So you're watching people make new shapes with their body and moving in new ways, and you think, oh, I need to learn how to make that shape myself and move in that way.
Absolutely. But there was also a thing about, like, I want to be able to know I'm going to do this move and that it's going to happen. And 1 year training wasn't enough. So it's interesting because my career has always been things, like you said, coming from the dark, not having ever seen contemporary dance, but a teacher telling me that, and that made me then fall in love with this art form of contemporary dance. Because up to that point, it could have been anything, what I could have become or end up being. And let's not forget that I was working for a dance company in Barcelona and going, and then I moved to Barcelona when I was 17 and doing my last year of high school.
Of course, you're still at school,
God. Where you're doing an exam at the end, and then that exam, all of your life depends on the note that you get on that exam to then become a doctor, become a scientist, become a journalist, become whatever you want to become. You do not get into university if you don't pass that exam. And the condition that my father gave me is you do that exam. And after that exam, then you can try the dance thing. So we had a deal.
So you got through that door?
I got through that exam. I could now go back to Spain and, you know, become anything if I wanted to become anything else, but I don't. But I got it for them, and then, you know, I was able to then, you know, move to London and so on.
So you went to London to train. And what did you learn in London?
For 2 years, I immersed myself in literally, just imagine Fame that we talked about. So
it was a school like Fame?
It was a school like Fame.
Like with other performing arts disciplines there?
Absolutely. It wasn't actually not a... that's the interesting thing about my life a little bit. When I think about it, that school was a musical theatre school. The best one. Yeah? So they were all triple, quadruple threats. Everyone could sing, could dance, could tap, could everything. But within that, they had a strain of contemporary and ballet.
So when you left Spain for London, did you have a feeling of escape? And were you looking to escape all this time?
Absolutely.
What were you escaping from, do you think?
Well, there was something about, you know, the family dynamic. So there was the personal side to it. And, you know, by that point with my dad, our conflict was really it was difficult. So I had to find my own way of surviving away, I guess.
And given that you were the sort of like the fly in the ointment in the family, what did you think you would be doing if you left the family at that point? Would that be a bad thing for the family, do you think?
No, I thought it would be a good thing. Because, you know, my father and I are in so much conflict that if I remove myself, you know, hopefully they will be able to, you know, find a way to move forwards.
And is that what happened, though?
It was all the opposite.
What happened?
What happened is my parents got divorced. My brothers, one by one, fell out with my father because we were not children anymore. So that sort of control that he had over the family, you know, we wanted to grow as a family together. There was also the role that women played. You know, it is so sad to think that things, you know, have changed, but not so much, you know. But, you know, my mom worked and did everything else. So as we grew older, we were like, that's not okay. As men, not like from the generation of my father, that was not okay for my father. That we, as the children of my mother, recognized that the woman, the wife, the mother cannot be doing everything.
So Spain was changing.
Spain was changing. Like, my father wasn't.
Your father wasn't. And what happened to him after this divorce?
He remarried, actually. And then he passed away in the early 2000s.
Did you get a chance to reconnect with him before he died?
Not me, actually, because I didn't make it in time because I was living in London. So as soon as we knew that my father was with lung cancer in the last stages, because a family member told us, I immediately... It's interesting because although we hadn't spoken for a very long time. As soon as I heard that he wasn't well, I just wanted to be there. But, you know, I bought a ticket for the morning after, and he passed away that night. But my mother, who wasn't his wife anymore, and my brothers were there with him in those last moments.
But by then you were internationally successful and the overachiever of the family. Did he ever let you know how proud he was of you?
No.
Do you think he was proud of you?
Yes. I like to think that. And I know that through other people, again, you know, conversations that I've had later in life, you know, and actually it's very sad. It's just, if I think about it, yes, I went through a lot and I wish things maybe would have been different, but I am the person that I am, you know, and I won't let that define me. But it's important to share stories because I know that there's still kids out there struggling.
Do you think you were, because you were so different, you had to escape to survive?
Yeah, and I wanted, there was that bit of it. But then if I think about the profession itself, I was still in Barcelona very much the only boy. I mean, I joined a company of only men and I knew I could have stayed there forever, but I wanted to be a better dancer. So there was also a thing about, I want to be better at this. And if I want to be better at this, I have to go to a school. So for 2 years, I took every class. I did ballet like 3 times a day because I wanted to be good. So there was a personal side of it, of escaping that and hoping that my family then found something to be happy. But it didn't happen. And then I wanted to be better.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can find more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
So after you improved all this technique at this school, you ended up joining one of Britain's leading contemporary dance companies, the Rambert Dance Company, and you joined as a dancer there and danced there for quite a while. But while you were doing those rehearsals as a dancer and performing, were you keeping an eye on what the choreographer was doing?
Well, yes. By now I knew it was called choreography. I was so lucky to have joined Rambert because Rambert, it's the oldest company in the UK. Before the Royal Ballet, Maria Rambert is, you know, was from the Ballet Russe.
Right, it goes back that far.
It goes back that far. They're about to be 100 years in 2026. She worked with Ballet Russe and then she started a dance school in London who trained Sir Frederick Ashton that then founded the Royal Ballet, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, so it finds its origins in Diaghilev, does it?
Absolutely,
that far back.
With Diaghilev. But by that point, Rambert had moved from ballet into full contemporary, of the now, creation dance company. So I signed the contract. I had never seen the company either, for full disclosure. So I keep doing this thing where I sign contracts, you know, without having seen the company. But I really needed a job. So I then saw the company and I was like, oh, they're famous. They're good. You know, they were the best. So I knew that. I just couldn't afford going to see them. So I saw them after I signed the contract and I was like, oh, phew, they're good. And I had the opportunity in my 12 years there to work with some of the greatest choreographers. And I think that was the best choreographic school I could have ever had.
And when you started to choreograph for the first time, how did you go?
Well, there was a season called workshop season, and the dancers of the company were invited to make a work. And I did that. And the director said, no, no, you're too young. And I was like, oh my God, I'm too young for this, I'm too young for that.
And how old were you?
I can't remember, early 20s.
Oh, really?
But I wanted a chance, and I must have been so annoying or persistent, or I don't know what I did, because I don't remember the details. But eventually he said, okay, Rafael, you can do a piece.
I imagine you'd be looking to be a choreographer at the age of 30 as when you don't have quite the same body you did as a teenager, for example. But no, you're doing this in your early 20s.
I mean, in my early 20s, because we had the opportunity to. Yeah, he gave me the chance. And that work that I made, called Three Gone, Four Left Standing, was taken into the repertoire of the company.
How long did it take you to find your style, though, as a choreographer?
Oh, much, much longer.
What were you doing wrong before that?
Well, you know, when I started to make work and I was within the protection and the context of Rambert, which was, you know, a well-known, recognized company, I was trying to be very modern and, you know, use really weird music. And, you know, like I saw myself from the outside instead of listening to myself from the inside. I was trying to be understated and really cool. It was a bit like American postmodern, you know. Mm. And then, but actually, I was a showgirl inside.
High kicks, that kind of thing.
I wanted high kicks and turns and really difficult steps, you know. But I was actually just swinging my arms and making the dancers wear really uncomfortable costumes, you know. But I was giving it a go and you really like, you know, falling flat on the floor. And so then eventually, yeah.
I know nothing about how choreography works. How do you start? Do you start sketching or do you start with a group of people in a room or is there any one approach you take?
There's all different approaches, and I never know when my next idea is going to come from. And often people think that choreographers or artists are, you know, connected to some sort of ongoing inspiration channel that comes to you and
That's
you see the
right.
light.
That doesn't happen.
No. It's hard work. And sometimes I look for the idea. I don't have one, but I'm going to look for one. So I always just need a concept, a thought, an idea that's going to drive me.
So do you carry a pencil and paper around with you? Will you go most places in case you're on the ferry or something? Seriously?
I love pencils. I'm obsessed with pencils. I have a collection, but I don't carry it with me all the time. Sometimes I do. And, you know, now, you know, I've discovered how can I just talk to my phone and it writes it.
Oh, so, dictation, right.
Yeah. Which, you know, sometimes it finds it hard with my accent, but, you know, I'm getting there. And I do that a lot in the street. So if I get an idea, instead of stopping and writing it, I'm just like, okay, blah, 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 la, 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 la.
So is there some kind of notation system for contemporary dance like music, or is that too constraining?
There is a notation system that works best for classical dance because the steps are more codified. So, you know, a passé, a relevé, you know, there's a name for everything. But for me, it's I write a lot. I do sort of drawings or more like maps of ideas. So I use writing, I use maps, I use paper. I always often start my process with a mind map, you know, with momenta. I have momenta in the middle. I have this big sheet of paper that's made out of 7 pieces of paper. And then I go into the internet and I start researching, you know, what is momenta? Momenta is the title of my latest work. Momenta is the plural of momentum. Momentum means something in physics, but there's also moment in time. So I go off and I start writing all these links, all these thoughts that have to do with momenta.
So you started with a word in that case, did you?
Yeah. For me, there's always writing and a word, sometimes poetry, a poem. I made a work that was fully based on the 4 quartets by T.S. Eliot, but I never told anyone. No one ever knew. So the composer composed the music following the 4 quartets by T.S. Eliot. I then choreographed following bits of chunks of the poetry. The work was called A Square Map of Q4. If you tell people this has been inspired on the 4 quartets, they'll be like, oh, I didn't see it.
When you're sketching things, when you're sketching, there's this moment after you have to go for a couple of weeks, but then there's this moment when suddenly the 3D image of it is in your head and you can sketch much better. Are you good at having that 3D picture in your head for what you want from your dancers?
Yes, I imagine the space, the theatre. Is there going to be design elements? Do I see one person? I'm often listening to the music when that happens. So it's often in the evening, you know, when I've been in the studio working during the day with the dancers.
So does the music lock in the image then in your mind?
Very much. I mean, I'm really driven by the music too. So there is the concept and the idea and then all of the links that I can find. But then the music for me, living with it and hearing it and just closing my eyes and being able to just let my imagination flow. And then sometimes an idea comes and sometimes I have no ideas. But then something takes me to the next.
I like contemporary dance way more than I enjoy ballet, which I don't really enjoy very much. But contemporary dance I love. But the thing about ballet is it seems to be something that's anchored to a conventional story, often a fairy tale. And we know the tropes of that story. But contemporary dance seems to have its own story that is mysterious, and it's something you might be able to figure out yourself. It seems like a much more mysterious art form. Do you have a story in your mind, or are you just letting, is it like surrealism? Do you let one thing sort of join to the other thing, not by some narrative logic, but by just some logic of imagery or fantasy or dream or something? How does it work?
It's the poetry of the body, you know, and we all understand the body. You know, we may not understand English or Spanish or Chinese or whatever language, but there's something that is so pure about the body. And in contemporary dance, you know, I really believe there is no guidelines or limits to what the audience can feel. And, you know, we're all individuals with a different worldview, different life experience. I'm sharing some of mine. So I will be affected by art in different ways. And it's like abstract paintings. You're talking about surrealism, abstract. It's liberating the fact that, you know, you can sit in a theater and experience something that's going to allow you to feel and to connect with it in your own way. For me, I absolutely hate when I'm being told what to think. Well, I don't hate it. It's just like boring. You know what I mean? I read the news or I watch the news. So with my work, I'm never trying to tell people what I think, how I feel, and I have an opinion and you must have my opinion because it's better than yours.
Yeah, it's the definition of kitsch, I think, to do it that
way. There you go.
Way.
So for me, with contemporary dance, they're all performing themselves on stage. They're not being a character that they have to try to achieve, you know? They're not being stereotyped in sort of gender roles.
So it's more primal then?
It's more primal. It's more human. It's more raw. It's the people themselves, you know?
So you've become at this point quite a cultured man through your own efforts. You're listening to Bella Bartok. You're doing this beautiful, sophisticated, very poetic art form. Then out of the blue, you're contacted by Kylie Minogue. What did Kylie ask you when she got in touch with you?
Well, it was an email, and the email said, subject Kylie. And I opened it, and it was like, oh, we came to see the performance at Sadler's Wells with Rambert, and we would like you to choreograph for the Brit Awards for Kylie. And I was like, what?
This is the song, Can't Get You Out of My Head.
The version that I did, it was mixed with another song.
New Order's Blue
New
Monday.
New Order.
Yeah.
I'm so happy that you remembered because I was going to have a moment now.
Yeah.
So the version that I did was the New Order with Can't Get You Out of My Head, which was amazing. And what was interesting is, like, you know, the video clip had been already out there and it was so famous and popular and wonderful. But then I had to do my own take. And I was like, Kylie, I said, I haven't done a pop song since I was 8. And she's like, that's what we want. We want you to bring something new into the pop world.
The image I get from that performance at the Brit Awards is she's like a fantasy figure. She's tiny and her moves are very, very fluid, but she's kind of got an army behind her. That's what it looks like to me.
Yeah,
there's that
army.
Kind of contrast. And it looks fantastic. Was that your intent or was that, am I off quite off the page here with that?
You know, suddenly I was in a situation where I could have 25 dancers. Why not? In a context that I had never experienced before. So for me, it was life-changing in every way. Obviously, the Brit Awards was like the test because I had not been in that environment of like million lights, screens, a singer coming out of the city thing and Kylie coming down. And after that, it was the world tour. They were like, oh, you've done an amazing job. It was in all the newspapers. Everyone was talking about it. Who is this, you know, Raphael guy? And then I got to do the Fever Tour, which was, you know, another amazing experience. But yes, for me, they really allowed me to be myself, but then also had to find my way within the pop world. You know, so for me to actually be able to find the right language, the right movement, the right steps for it, and somehow that seemed to hit the nail because, you know, I was given a lot of trust and I was given an opportunity that at that point in the contemporary dance world, I had not been given yet.
You recently joined her in Las Vegas.
She
was doing her Vegas show there.
I did.
How was that to visit her and see her perform in Las Vegas of all places?
It was incredible. She's amazing. I had the time of my life. The show was incredible. Yeah, it was really like unexpected because, you know, we were trying to like meet and kept crossing each other. She was going to New York the week after we were performing in New York. So I was like, I'm going. It was incredible.
I see Kylie in a way as kind of a little bit of Australian chocolate cake that was going to lure you to Australia one way or another eventually. Tell me how it was, though, you were brought into the Sydney Dance Company to begin with, Raphael.
It's interesting because I was invited to create a work in 2008 because by that point I had already become an independent choreographer. So I had my company in London, but I was also taking commissions to survive because my company was only project-based. And I was coming here for 2 months and then going back to London, where I had been for 20 years by this point. And I was working with Kylie on and off, which gave me great opportunities in the more commercial world of the business of dance and movement. And whilst I was here, they were looking for an artistic director. And they approached me to do an interview. And at first I was like, no. I live in London. I've been working there for 20 years. I was very happy in London.
And then what happened?
And then by, you know, after 2 months, I was like, you know what? How can I say no to an opportunity like this? A company that's so loved and cherished in Australia that, you know, it's based in a place like nowhere in the world.
Like right on Sydney Harbour.
Right on Sydney Harbour, on Walsh Bay Arts Precinct. on the ocean, on the water. And I started to visualize what I could do, maybe, and what I could try to do. And people responded really well to that work that I made as a guest. So audiences seemed to connect. And then I just thought, okay, I'm doing the interview, but I won it. Like, it wasn't like, oh, let's see what happens. By that point that I did the interview the day before I left Australia, Sydney, the job was mine, in my head. Things were not that easy, and there was a series of feather interviews, and it took 2 months, and other people went for the job, and it was everything. But I didn't just do it as a like, oh, if it works. I really saw myself.
You came in under really fraught circumstances. A woman, Tanya Liedtke, had been appointed artistic director of the Sydney Dance Company after the departure of Graham Murphy after all those years. And then she was killed in a late-night car accident, which was unthinkable. And I read that the company sort of went into shock for about a year after that. So it was about after a year after her death that they turned to you as someone who was going to bring the energy back and lift the company up again. Did you have a sense of that, of lifting a company out of a kind of protracted state of grief and shock back into the light again?
I was friends with Tanya, and I knew Tanya very well.
Because she invited you in the first place to Australia, didn't she?
She did, but no one knew that because she had been appointed artistic director of the Sydney Dance Company, but it was still embargoed, that's the word. And we met in London for a coffee, and she told me the news, and I was like, oh my God, congratulations, because I could not have thought of a better person to lead the Sydney Dance Company into the future. And she had some ties to Australia because she danced here with Australian Dance Theatre. She had lived here with her family, although she was born in Germany, but she spoke fluent Spanish because she had always lived in Madrid. She was just an incredible artist. You know, that happened, and then I forgot about the Sydney Dance Company because my only connection to the Sydney Dance Company ever was that Tanya Liedtke had been appointed artistic director.
Oh, and she'd invited you before her appointment had been confirmed, so yeah. No one else knew that you'd
no
been
one else
asked.
Knew. No, one,
you,
else
no
knew.
One else knew you'd been asked to come and do a work for Sydney Dance Company.
Yeah, no one else knew. And then when I was approached a year later or at some point, I did ask the Sydney Dance Company, are you asking me because this was on Tanya's plans? And it's like, we never knew Tanya's plans because she never made it to her first day at work. And then I spoke to the family members because I was like, well, I feel like I need to talk to them because she was my connection to the Sydney Dance Company. And they said, do it, do it, do it. Because that's one of the things that she wanted. And then I ended up being the director. But everything was really not planned and unexpected. And yes.
Moving to Australia, the landscape's so different. You'd been in cold and wet London, and now you're working in a place that's right on the edge of Sydney Harbour. There's much more natural light. The birds sound different. The trees smell of eucalyptus. It's a very different place. Do you think that affected your creativity? Do you think it affected the way, the kind of things you were making once you moved here?
I have no doubt that it has. I don't know what would have been of my work and if I would have stayed in London. I was happy in London. I wasn't looking for escape like when I left Barcelona. When I left Barcelona, I was looking to escape.
And London was that escape initially?
Yeah. And in London, I was happy. And I had everything. You know, the UK really supported my career first as a dancer. I got everything I ever wanted. The opportunity of Sydney Dance Company came as something that they invited me a commission. They asked me to do the interview. I got the job. And within a week, I made my suitcase and I moved to Australia. And it's been 16 years. Like, I have never, ever missed London. My friends, for the first 2 or 3 years, they'd be like, when are you coming back? Then they stop asking when you're coming back. Because I'm Australian, I could not be happier. It was meant to be. You know, there was the Kylie moment. But also, it's worth mentioning that in my company in London, there were 6 dancers and 4 were Australian. So my connection to Australia, for some reason, it was like... And then here, I was born in Barcelona, a place with light, with water, with the sea. You know, there's something about the spirit of people also that I feel that here in Australia... From day one, I was like, oh, yeah, you know, this is
perfectly
this is
at right. home.
Yeah. I'm, that's it. I walk to work. I get in my scooter, you know, the sun is shining.
You created all these groundbreaking, beautiful works that toured all over the world. In 2016, you had this quite a wild idea because you like to collaborate. So you collaborated with the Gallery in New South Wales to put on a performance there where all the dancers were nude. And then there were special performances where the audience was nude as well. How quickly did the tickets for those all-nude nights move Did it sell out?
It was like, I don't know, within, I'm going to say half an hour, it was sold out. maybe it was 30 seconds. I don't know. But we did it as an experiment, and it was one night, which was a nudist audience night. And then it sold out so quickly, we had to add a few more. I can't remember how many, maybe two more nudist performances.
And how did that work as a performance? Did people arrive with their clothes on, obviously, and then they disrobed somewhere? And
yeah, we went down the escalators at the New South Wales Art Gallery, as you know, the coffee shop down there. And then we all had a paperback with a pen, which is where we would put our clothes safely. And then I talked to the audience like I did every night, because obviously the performance was dancers within the space of the gallery with some of the greatest art brought by the Tate Gallery collection. So because there was dance performance plus audience moving around in a context that people are not used to, I just had to tell people, like, make sure that you don't bump into the art as you're walking backwards or something, you know.
Don't have a nasty accident.
Most importantly, make sure that you don't touch the art unless the art touches you, meaning the dancers who were absolutely in the nude. And that was for the clothed audience. So it was the same speech for the nude audience. And then I said, and now let's disrobe, yeah? That's what you said. Let's take our clothes off. So then I started, you know, because I had to do it. And I was like, oh my God, everyone knows who I am. I guess so, because they've come to my show, but I don't know anyone.
You had to take a deep breath then just to even think about it, I think, to even remember it then in that moment.
You know, and I promise you, I didn't even have a shot of tequila or anything. I was like, I've got to be really, like, because it was an experiment, and especially the first one, I didn't know how it was going to feel. So then I just asked everyone to follow me. And then we all just walked down the corridor of, you know, that took us to the art. And it was just an incredible sense of oneness.
Vulnerability?
Vulnerability also. Broad-mindedness. Because we were all doing something that felt a little bit like mysterious and weird, but also really profound.
Well, you'd have dancers on performing with really beautiful bodies, but people in the audience wouldn't have had such beautiful bodies at all. But was there something in that?
No, there was all sorts of bodies. And that was the most beautiful thing about it, because some people could have looked like a dancer or not. But at times, you know, we all became the art. Also, there was a sense of inclusivity because, you know, you walk into a place wearing a suit. So everyone was like, oh, he's corporate and boring. You walk into a place with a tracksuit and people judge you. You know, people will always judge by the way that we dressed.
And a suit is a kind of suit of armor in some ways too. So what happens when they take that off? Do they change their demeanor? Do they change the way they look? And
yeah, and someone might be tattooed neck to toe under the suit because they're incredibly experimental and whatever they like. So, but what was beautiful and incredible and moving was actually that often we have life marks in our body.
Scars,
operations, bits missing. And everyone was brave to come together.
Were you surprised by how affected audience members were? Did they surprise you in the ways they were affected by the dance that they were seeing?
It was life-changing. It was really transformative for the dancers, because suddenly they've been doing all these performances with people clothed and them fully unclothed. There was only one moment where the people came together as one in one room for one little performance. So the dancers grabbed the audience and we came to the central space. And then the dancers had to feel if they were able to hug the audience.
The audience member.
Member.
Right.
And do a bit of a waltz. Very simple, lovely waltz for a moment. And that happened for many nights clothed. And that happened in the nudist or unclothed night, where we all came together in the nude in one room. And there was people crying.
People crying?
Crying, yeah. Because, you know, the stories, the backgrounds, all ages, all body shapes, you know, the most human, that it was so, yeah, transformative experience and spellbinding. You know, I have no words almost to explain it.
I saw on that special that was made on your life on Virginia Trioli's Creative Types show, it was very moving. I saw your brother talking to her via Zoom, and he said he was quite overcome with emotion himself. He said when he tries to teach his kids about what it means to be a brave person and have the courage of your convictions, he brings you up all the time. What was it like for you to see your brother Say such a lovely thing about you, Raphael.
Well, I was in tears too, because it was thrown at me as a surprise by Virginia, which was wonderful. So I knew that they were interviewing him, but I didn't know. My brother was like, yeah, you know, he's like, yeah, muy bien, very good. You know, he just, he's very funny.
He could say that to Virginia in a way, but he might not have been able to say that to you as quite so easily.
But yeah, because we've never spoken about it. So the truth is that we speak a lot about our youth. You know, my brother has come to Australia. My Ivan is his name. He's taken his children to Paris to see the Sydney Dance Company. He has three kids, and they all have very different hobbies as kids. So, you know, my brother bought ballet shoes for his son, Bruno. And that was like, my brother calling me, like, where can I buy ballet shoes for my son? Was like heartbreaking. So, you know, the fact that my brothers have become such beautiful male-presenting human beings who are so loving to his children and to their partners. For me, it's a lot to do with, you know, what we saw as kids and then how much my mother, you know, loved us and gave us. Yes, there was a lot that went on with my dad wanting to make us, you know, feel that life was hard from the very beginning, but without all of the efforts of my mother. She was like the barrier in a way, like the armor between him and us, and she took it all, you know, and they've become incredible parents and men and human beings. So yes, I was very proud, but we've never spoken about it. I've sent them the link because in Spain you cannot, so they gave me a link so my brother could see the program. No, he was really moved and happy and yeah.
What an amazing life story. It's been so wonderful speaking with you, Raphael. Thank you very much.
Well, Richard, it's been an absolute joy also talking to you. I could be here for the next 7 hours.
I could too. Raphael Bonicella is the Artistic Director of the Sydney Dance Company. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.